You are now listening to Well-Fed Women, the show that's been radically changing the way women perceive health, fitness, and their bodies since 2015. I'm your host, Noelle Tarr. Submit your questions to wellfedwomen@gmail.com, and you can keep up with the show on Instagram at wellfedwomen. Welcome to the Well-Fed Women podcast. This is episode number 297. I am your host, Noelle Tarr of coconutsandkettlebells.com. I'm a nutritional therapy practitioner and a certified personal trainer. Today, I'm here with Stephanie Ruper, PhD. We are so happy to have you with us, and we're excited to hang out. We're going to be discussing a variety of topics, including how to pursue exercise goals while you're struggling with adrenal fatigue or you have some sort of reaction, like a gut reaction. We're going to also be discussing the move away from paleo, both in holistic health and on this podcast, and possible causes of waking up in the middle of the night. And then we'll round out our discussion with some discussion on how to flush out excess hormones. Before we jump in, Juve, the leading brand when it comes to effective and safe red light therapy at home, has officially launched their next generation of devices, and they've made huge upgrades to what is already the best red light therapy systems on the market. Their new devices are sleeker, they're 25% lighter, and they've also intensified their coverage area, so you can stand as much as 3 times further away from the device and still get that recommended dosage. And we have a discount exclusively for the Well-Fed Women community. You all know how much I love red light therapy because it literally stimulates energy production by improving mitochondrial function. This basically translates to better functioning cells, and studies have shown it reduces inflammation. It can reduce the need for thyroid medication when targeted specifically at the thyroid. It can support your immune system and hormone balance and can help regulate proper circadian rhythms. I sit in front of my Juve red light therapy every morning, and I've most recently been using it while weaning since I have had 8 different cases of mastitis in my first year postpartum associated with inflammation and oversupply. Yes, we did all the other digging before you try to tell me it was because of a tongue tie and a lip tie. We had those revised at day 7, so wasn't that. But I'm happy to report I haven't had a single issue and have almost completely weaned just naturally with my kid's rhythm, without any infection, without any issue whatsoever, because I think personally that it is because I introduced red light therapy and I now do that daily. The new devices include some really cool new features like recovery mode, which utilizes a pulsing technology to give your cells an extra boost of recovery from tough workouts, and an ambient mode for calming lower intensity of light at night to support sleep, which is important. If you're looking for a new Juve device for your home, you can find a discount for us. This is pretty exclusive, folks. Okay, so go do it now because it is for a limited time. Juve.com, JOOVV.com/WellFed. And then just make sure you have the code WellFed applied and you'll get an exclusive discount on the newest devices. The discount is specific to the device, so it's all over the place. So it's for a limited time only, but it is a really good chunk off. So jump on that, get the discount, Juve, JOOVV.com/WellFed. Hey, Stephanie, PhD.
Yo.
So when you get your doctorate in philosophy, does anybody refer to you as Dr. or Stephanie Ruper, or is it like Stephanie Ruper, PhD?
You mean aside from me?
Aside from us.
Yeah, so my formal title is Dr., and I do use it on my post. Like, come at me, you know. I have this whole shtick where I dislike the distinction between Miss and Mrs. And, you know, having to do with like the history of property and whatever. So I like Doctor because it's a title that I sort of chose and worked for. And so, yeah, Dr. Stephanie Ruper and Stephanie Ruper, PhD mean the same thing. And if I were giving an academic talk, they would introduce me as Dr. Stephanie Ruper, but I wouldn't ever insist on it. I'd be like, call me Steph.
Of course. Oh, no. No, you don't have to do that. Oh, yeah. That's awesome. Cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the discussion requests questions was just an update on your lives, which we kind of do that anyway. But tell me about what's...
Now we have an excuse.
Now we can go to those iTunes reviews that say, stop talking about yourself. Just get right to the questions. See, somebody does want to hear about it. What's been going on with you? How's your... I know we talked a lot about your surgery and all that previously, but how's it been going? Have you still noticed less headaches, and how are you feeling overall?
Thank you. It's going well. I have had a handful of headaches. It has... today is 4 weeks to the day since my surgery, and I think I've had four headaches, but I think they're all related to... I'm still triggered by the same things, but it takes a lot more. And the headaches that I've experienced, I think, are all related to inflammation that is normal but persisting, right? Because when I can tell when I eat something spicy or hot, or I'm in a room with hot, dry air, I can feel the parts of my nose get like inflamed and expand, and breathing gets more difficult. And so I suspect that as my nose continues to heal, it will continue to get better. So there's really only going up from here. And things that normally really bother me still continue to be less bothersome, like lights and the sun and stuff that normally people tolerate okay. So yeah, things are continuing to, I think, be promising.
Are you coming home for the holidays at all?
That's a great question. Hopefully by the time this airs, I'll have a better answer to it. As it stands, I currently don't have a visa for the United Kingdom. I applied months ago. If we want to start a campaign to the visa office in the UK to help me along, that would be great. I currently don't have a visa here, and you just wait. So I don't know when it's going to come back, but I can't leave the country and then come back without a visa. So hopefully that comes through in time for the holidays. I would guess as much, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Probably.
The million-dollar question, are you seeing anybody?
When aren't I?
This is true.
It's funny. I vacillate between being I don't know how to put this in a way that is appropriate for this podcast, but I tend to vacillate between extremes. Sometimes I am very hardcore celibate and against dating, and for me personally, not like ethically against it, but just decide that I'm not doing it. And then the other half of the time and I never stop flirting anyway. I don't know how to stop. So am I seeing anybody? I've been on a few dates with people who are really lovely, but I personally, I'm just honestly so excited about being single right now. I just love it. I love it so much. It's not that, romantic love isn't exciting, but I am really enjoying being responsible just for me. And I think it's so important for me right now to learn that. I don't know how much I can't remember if I talked about this much recently on the podcast, but my biggest project for me right now is learning how to not feel responsible for other people's feelings. And
how's that going?
Actually, pretty well. It's been, I think especially, I've always had this as a problem, but it's increased a lot over the years. And especially with COVID, it was just sort of set on fire because all of a sudden everybody's lives were a few grades worse than they were before. And I felt so obliged and got into these habits where I would just obsess over how much more love I could be putting out in the world. And I would run through rosters in my head of all the people I know who could like use support. And I would, and it became a lot. And I was really just like, my energy was just bleeding out of me, and I was becoming frazzled and incapable of caring for myself, and then in turn for other people and for showing up for them in a genuine way, because it was a challenge for me. And so the experiences were more strained and all that sort of stuff. And I was just like, this has to stop. It just has to stop, period. Not being romantically involved with anybody is really helpful for that too, because that has tons of subtleties and nuances in terms of how much you lean on each other and that sort of thing. So it's been extremely, it's been hard. It's been hard. I've had a lot of nights where I've struggled to sleep, but I'm sort of rebuilding my resilience to that and affirming things like I have gifts that I need to use to serve the world. And if I'm draining them all the time, then I can't use them. And the people in my life don't want me to be responsible for their feelings. You know, like, you know, they asked me, some of them asked me to like mentally experiment, you know, like, do you want me to be responsible for your feelings? I was like, no. And they're like, okay, same. And I had developed this habit of, in all of my conversations, like going back at the end and apologizing for everything that I might have possibly said that could have possibly upset them, because I was so worried about upsetting people. And then people started doing it back to me, and I was like, well, this is awful. yeah. And so, yeah, so I've been challenging myself in that way and doing a lot of positive affirmations and sort of working on rewiring my brain to be more balanced. And it's really great. It's really great. And it's a challenge, but it's just a testament to the fact that we really can have a degree of control over what we think about and what we feel and, you know, manage our emotional landscapes. We don't have, you know, we don't have complete control, but we do have some. And yeah, keep fighting the good fight, everybody.
Thank you. Thank
Turn
you, Stephanie.
That into something that can maybe help somebody. I don't know.
Do you resonate with being a highly sensitive person? Or is...
You know what's so funny? Somebody said that to me the other day and was talking about that the other day. And I thought about it this morning. Sorry for interrupting you. I just thought it was so funny that I was literally thinking about the concept of highly sensitive people today. I'm not sure what I think about it. I have a lot of thoughts and feelings that are probably not, that a lot of people probably wouldn't like to hear about them. I think no. I think definitely throughout my entire life on a physical level, I've identified as a highly sensitive person. And that's just been like a biological fact. I mean, like, I can't even look at the sun.
Yeah. So, yeah. Like, yeah.
So in that way, yes. Emotionally, I'll just say it. I absolutely think that some of us tend to be more sensitive than others for a wide variety of reasons. They're biochemical, they're psychological, they're historical, they're whatever, they're embedded in our lives. We are sensitive. And I know people who are incredibly empathetically like embedded with the people around them. They see somebody cry, they start crying. And it's just a very natural response. And that's not something for me. And that's totally a personality difference. That's just part of how I'm wired. But I do think the degree to which we are sensitive to one another is something that we can, you know, it's not like, it's not a concrete, unmovable thing, right? Like, we can do work, we can sort of explore that space in ourselves and in relationship with one another. I really do think that if this sensitivity is something that is painful, it can be blunted, you know, if we decide that we want to work on it. So those are some thoughts I have about high sensitivity. Why? Do you? You don't.
Do identify. I consider myself to be a highly sensitive person? Are you asking?
Yes. Yes.
I do not. No.
Yeah.
I am probably the opposite end of the spectrum. No, I am a very sensitive and emotional person, but I'm also, I much prefer directness and... I don't know. I think I'm still trying to figure myself out, because I can be very impacted by the way something is said to me by my husband, but at the same time, I can also be not at all affected by it and just like, oh, okay, get over it. But I'm,
it's like, it's human to be affected, right? By the world around you, for sure. And some of us to varying degrees. I just, I think that if we can work on it, if we don't want to be.
Right. Yeah. I think I've mentioned here before too, like, you know, things can stir me up or whatever, especially when we're talking about conflict and even just like social media and stuff like that. Things can unsettle me, but like, I don't like conflict. Whereas like, you know, Enneagram 8s are like, yeah, you know, I've seen that in very close friends who people are like, oh, I hate it when people say I don't like confrontation. And I'm like, I really actually don't, though. So I don't love confrontation, but I do not shy away or back down from it, speaking my mind. And I typically, you know, I just don't, it's not something, I don't feel super emotional or whatever. Like, I'm very straightforward. I like being straightforward. I like honesty and directness, and a lot of people don't like the, you know, being direct. And, so I don't know. Still figuring myself out. I'm almost 35 and don't know who I am. Just kidding.
We are all forever on the way and
yeah,
in flux. And that's, that's that. And I think I don't know. Like, I think you're right that some people, conflict can feed them in certain ways, for sure.
And that's not to say it's a bad thing. I just, yeah.
It could be, but it also doesn't have to be, right? Like, all of our traits, our sensitivity or insensitivity, could be or not, right? It depends on what we do with it. And I really think, for me personally, like, there are things that are really hard for me. I mean, sometimes I have trouble sleeping at night because, like, I texted somebody and I, like, left out a word, or I used one heart instead of two hearts and they used two hearts and I didn't reciprocate enough. And, like, that's the kind of, like, that can send me into an anxious spiral. And, yeah, I'm sensitive to that, but I don't, like, I believe that I can build my resilience to it, right?
Yes.
And so that's what I'm working on right now. You know, we do want our environments to be safe for us, but there's also the problem where you can never guarantee that your environments will be fully safe for you. And I do try to be in environments that are healthy for me. At the same time, I want to be able to be in as many environments as possible. And so I'm working on, you know, the way that I relate to these things that, you know, I have sensitive triggers to.
Yeah, that makes sense. Building the resilience. And I think that's an important part of building your own health, too, is, like,
yes,
seeing what kind of things trigger you, but also building resilience to it and understanding, like, you can get yourself out of a spiral, you know. Anyway, Brooke, update on my life. Actually, there's been a lot of change in the last few weeks, and this week has just been particularly overwhelming AF. And I did announce on here before that my husband is now back to active duty Marine Corps. It's been an awesome shift for us. We have our weekends free now, and they are all working from home more right now. And so he's been home a lot. It's a lot of phone stuff for him, coordination. He coordinates movement of individuals. And so it is a lot of phone time. He's at home more, but we have a babysitter now that is coming to the house. She was an au pair. She's from Poland. Met a guy, got married, and now lives here, and is kind of trying to figure out what she wants to do. She's working on university, and so she's comes for a few hours every day, and it's just been really great to have a level of productivity again that I enjoy. So obviously that gives me life. But, you know, with him being back in the Marine Corps, that's just been a very big shift. And it's like a breath of fresh air, you know, like a little bit of a cloud is lifted off of our house, which is really nice. And we have a little bit of a better family dynamic. And my son, like I mentioned before, weaning and me not really breastfeeding as much anymore has been amazing, just because the last 2 years of my life has really been associated with, like, a lot of infections. And I had something called Raynaud's, which was very painful when breastfeeding. And so that's been swept aside, which is great. And I've been doing a lot of just, like, focusing on how I can, what is it that I enjoy doing and how do I do more of it? So I will be honest, I kind of get life from doing reels on Instagram. I was so resistant.
Wait.
What?
If y'all don't follow Noelle on Instagram, if you don't have an Instagram, create an Instagram and follow Coconuts and Kettlebells and nobody else, because her reels are out of this world.
I've only done three. But I have been
working. They're so good. They're just so good. They're authentic, but they're polished. They're brilliant. They're funny. You're fantastic. Okay, go on. Sorry.
Thank you so much. I accept. I accept it.
Wait, one more thing. Coconuts and Kettlebells has moved up all the way on the left to my, like, story creep. You know, at the, you get the top, you get your ranking of your story creeping.
Yeah.
Coconuts and Kettlebells is up there, and I just
That's
do
hilarious.
Recommend.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. I love that. Background on me is that I used, like, if TikTok, so okay, I've been fighting TikTok. Like, and I'm not on TikTok. I don't want to be on TikTok. I don't want another social media platform. And so, but I have been kind of in awe of how well some of these videos are choreographed and what's, you know, just like the production of it. When I was 7, 8, 9, 10, probably all the way through junior high, I used to make with my best friend, I used to make videos of, like, we would create news shows. Actually, what I wanted to do up until I was about 18 or 19, I wanted to be in news media and be a reporter. And then I realized what the hours were, and I was like, hell no, thank you. But, you know, we would do create these shows, and we would create commercials. And so it was very much so video production and coordinating, you know, a storyline and all that fun stuff. It was just for, and we just did it for fun. You know, we would record it with our camcorder and watch it back and laugh. And so that has, all of a sudden, that has come out with these reels. So I'm like, in my head, I'm thinking through, you know, I hear a song or I see a reel that somebody did and I get sort of inspired. And then I'm like creating this scene in my head. And then I'm like, I have got to do this. And so the thing has been, the tech side of it, because it is a little hard to like figure out how to do the text and how do you do really close cuts. And anyway, it's been a lot of fun. And I do feel slightly more excited to be on social media because I feel like I've found a way that I enjoy and it gets a message across and it resonates with people. It's not like me taking a picture of myself or me taking a picture of food or whatever, you know. So that's been nice, and it does take a little bit more time, but I've been putting more effort into getting getting my message out better on social media, which has been nice, and being very intentional with how do I want to communicate with the world, and do I want to do I really care about trying to put effort into Facebook or trying to put effort into, like, so where am I reaching people and just sticking with that and not driving myself insane? So this has been like kind of a fun past few months. I have a lot of great interviews scheduled for this month, which I'm very excited about. I've gotten a lot of really good, I've been very intentional about researching, trying to find good people, and then reaching out to them and then getting them to respond to me. Believe me, I reach out to a lot of people. And I'm just really excited because I've had a lot of good people respond. And so I've got some good episodes that I'm going to be recording, which does take a lot of prep work. And anyway, actually, I think we're going to get to a question like that coming up. I don't know if it's today. It might be in our next episode, but it is about like, how do you kind of choreograph all of that when you have so much going on? But anyway, I mean, I'm just excited. I think it's a fun time. I'm finally coming out of this like dark hole, and, you know, I can like actually get in the shower and do my makeup and hair again. And I feel like, oh, like I look normal. I hope that doesn't sound like when you go through a phase where you're not, you've had all these body changes and you've had pregnancy and you've just been in a hole, it's nice to like, oh, I can put clothes on again and makeup and do my hair. And like, I feel like myself, you know, like I feel presentable, which I haven't in a while. So that's been fun. Would you like to get into questions now that we're halfway into the episode?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that was a question.
It was a question. That's true. Oh, and I've been baking a ton. I've really dove into cookies. And so like literally every weekend for the past 8 weeks has been like 8 or 9 different cookie tests. So I do have a link, coconutsandkettlebells.com/cookie. That's my cookie recipe book. It's just a free ebook, and it's like basically 10 cookie recipes that are more holiday centric. So like snickerdoodles and molasses cookies and all that kind of stuff. And they're all grain free. And dairy free. You can sub ghee out if you need to, but I like using ghee in cookies. So mostly, you know, paleo ish. I don't use that title anymore, which again, we'll get to that in a second, but let's get to question number one. I'll link to that in the show notes. coconutsandkettlebells.com/cookies. It's not hard to
/cookies.
coconutsandkettlebells.com/cookies.
This is who we are now.
This is okay. Who we are. Question number one. This is a two-part question. The first question is from Annika. She says, how to pursue exercise goals without activating the stress response, assuming you're not in acute stress, just normal daily stress. I find that if I do a moderate workout, not HIIT, I get bloated, presumably due to activating the stress response later in the evening. And then, there was a kind of a follow-up question to this from Jennifer Fry. Hi, Jennifer. How to decrease cortisol and adrenal numbers? I feel like exercise doesn't help like it should. I need to run, but shouldn't exhaust my adrenals more. And I feel like one thing keeps happening after another, and it just spirals out of control. How can I even prevent it now and take care of the damage? Okay. This is like two. So we can do, if you want to do Annika's first or whatever, and then we can kind of talk about Jennifer's or whatever. You just do you.
Yeah, no, I think what I will contribute to this conversation probably applies to both instances, right? Because mm-hmm. what we're looking at here is how stressful is exercise? And the answer is it depends on where you're at in your life, right? If you look at your stress levels and your adrenal outputs, and there are other reasons for you to be stressed or that resting might be good for you, then exercise is going to kind of tip the scale, right? I always think about a lot of these big health effects in terms of an equation where you've got like one thing plus the other thing plus the other thing plus the other thing, and what's your output? And if you can keep some of them low, if your life stress is low, if you're getting lots of sleep, if you're getting all the nutrients, you don't have any sort of gut issues, then like throw a ton of exercise in there and you're like, you're good to go because your other ones are so in check, right? But if you've been recovering from giving birth, from having any sort of health conditions, from low sleep, from having a stressful period in your life, from living in a time of global pandemic, then, you know, the extent to which you're exercising, I think, should probably mediate alongside those other variables, right? You're going to want to reduce it. A quick antidote, unscientific N equals one from my life. I exercise a lot. I always have. And throughout this pandemic, I was doing a lot, hours and hours of cycling every day, 50 miles a day, you know? And I got surgery about a month ago and I was commanded not to exercise. And since then, I have done a few yoga workouts and lifted dumbbells here and there and done squats. And my fitness is way declined. I went out cycling this morning for the first time in, in a month. And there's a marked difference in my fitness level. But at the same time, I think my body is just like really loving it. And so my questions would be like, what are your fitness goals and why? If your goal is to feel good, then do the amount of exercise that feels good for you. If it causes symptoms, then crank it down. You know, if you're having adrenal symptoms, if you're having gut symptoms, whatever, crank it down for a while, right? Rest takes longer than we think, you know, like 6 hours or 24 hours or 48 hours. Sometimes it's not enough. Sometimes you need weeks or months, right? So definitely consider like that when you're looking at your exercise. And also, I lost my train of thought a little bit. You definitely want to be considering that. And I also think just rest is really important. That's really all that I can say. You want to choose exercise that fits the shape of the rest of your life. And if it feels like too much, then it is. In terms of, if it's high intensity, do it briefly. Cardio is also like pretty stressful, right? If you're doing it for a long period of time. And so, that's it for me. Exercise does take adrenal like power, right? So exercise is not the solution to your adrenal levels, your stress levels being high, you know? It's not the solution to that.
Right.
It is the opposite, I would say. I would definitely come down pretty strongly on that, you know. One thing you might want to do if you have adrenal problems is cut out caffeine. Like, I just cannot.
Yeah.
It's big. It's like, it's really, really big. And it has effects on your immune system and therefore on your gut and all this sort of stuff. So Yeah, anything that's stressful, and I'm just going to throw coffee in there. Coffee is intrinsically stressful. It's just like it's drinking a cup of stress hormones, basically.
That's so true.
It is.
Yeah, right? It is. So, anyway, exactly what it does. It basically, like, immediately you free up cortisol. So.
And my first sip of coffee, okay, I love coffee, but I should not drink it because it does horrible things to me. But the first, like, 5 minutes into a cup of coffee are heaven. And then for the next 4 hours, I'm, like, banging my head against the desk. I'm like, why did I do that? My heart is racing. My immune system is going haywire. So, but anyway, those are my thoughts about exercise, my long thoughts.
Yeah. Go on. I'll dive in just a little bit deeper into, like, the hacking this. I think one of the things that's confusing in our culture is exercise is, you know, this wonderful thing that everybody should be doing, and it reduces stress and it improves your health. But that's not always applicable, especially when we are talking about adrenal dysfunction or high stress times. It is it can be an additional stressor. So depending on what your physiology is and where you're at and your stress hormones and all that kind of stuff, what you do can negatively impact your body. Scientifically, and when we talk about the research, you can actually, so high intensity workouts always in the short term increase cortisol. However, later on in the nighttime, levels decrease. And this is assuming healthy individuals. So you will always, when we're talking about high intensity exercise in the short term, you'll always see an increase in cortisol. And if you're an unfit individual, like, you know, you haven't been doing fitness for a while, even that moderate exercise can increase cortisol. However, as you get more fit, that response is lowered. In other words, you don't see that the same spike, or that spike is much less the more you do something. So that's kind of that adaptation process happening. In contrast to maximum effort exercise, mild or moderate exercise at 40 to 60% of maximum effort does not increase cortisol in the short term and still leads to lower levels at night. So I think that's something really interesting when we look at mild to moderate. So what does that look like? That's like Pilates and stretching. That's walking outside. That's doing these very low intensity exercises. It doesn't raise your cortisol, and it still leads to that decrease in cortisol at night, which is kind of what we all want, right? When we have dysregulated cortisol, when we're talking about adrenal dysfunction, a quote unquote adrenal fatigue, we're typically not sleeping well. You know, we have inhibited melatonin production, and cortisol is higher at night. And so we want that decrease. And so I think that you can still incorporate mild to moderate within reason, understanding what we do and knowing what we do about how to decrease cortisol overall. And when we look at the literature, deep breathing, and I talked about this with Krista, in my episode that launched the first week in October. She talked about deep breathing. Literally, that's like her number one thing. And it's shown in the literature that it can be used for stress reduction, and that there was like a study of 28 middle-aged women, it found nearly a 50% reduction in cortisol with habitual deep breathing training, which is kind of insane. That just goes to show how we're not breathing properly. We're not, like, deep breathing, like being intentional with your breath can majorly decrease cortisol. And multiple studies have confirmed that yoga can reduce cortisol. It can help manage stress, as well as Tai Chi. So think of that slower, more restorative, deep breathing movement. Pilates is kind of the same track. Studies have also shown that relaxing music can decrease cortisol. And there was this interesting study that showed that 30 men and women who gardened experienced greater cortisol reduction than those who read indoors, which kind of leads you to see that, like, being outdoors, exposed to sunshine, actually helps you reduce cortisol. So ideally, what we could do in this scenario is go for a walk outside with the sun, with relaxing music on, and that would really result in some decreased cortisol and improved cortisol rhythms, and also just a reduction in stress. So with Annika, with your question about, you know, this moderate exercise leading to bloating issues, I'm not totally positive that moderate exercise is in fact triggering the bloating and digestive issues, because if you're not dealing with adrenal dysfunction, and what we know about moderate exercise is that it's, if it's not HIIT, it's moderate exercise, and you've been doing this and you're a fit individual, it's not really resulting in an increase in cortisol. It's more of like a downstream symptom. And so I don't think it's like A equals B here. It's not this equals this. I kind of think probably what would be ideal is to really figure out maybe what's going on in your gut. Is there other times where this bloating occurs? And also, I do think, I mean, if it's running, that's, of course, related. So I when my research about running in particular, because, of course, I was a runner. I've done marathons and half Ironmans and all the things. And obviously, we know when you're running or cycling and you're doing this endurance training, which is technically a moderate effort, your blood is shunted away from your digestive organs, and it goes to your muscles to help your muscles do the work that it's you're being required of it. And so that really can trigger IBS and, you know, digestive issues and the runner's runs and all of that kind of stuff. But there was some interesting research that was done, I think, by a guy out of Monash University. And he was talking about how long term, and this is really interesting. So if you've ever run or you've ever done triathlons, you know, anything that's ever been an endurance effort close to 2 hours, this is really important to hear. So the redistribution of the blood flow away from the gut can create a gut cell injury that may lead to cell death, leaky gut, and systemic immune responses due to the intestinal bacteria entering the general circulation. So that's kind of what leaky gut is we have this damage to the enterocytes, and then something gets through and it gets into your bloodstream, and then, you know, your immune system launches an attack on it. So the problem is they're calling it exercise-induced gastrointestinal syndrome. And it was kind of like a review of a lot of research, but 2 hours appeared to be the threshold. And after 2 hours of continuous endurance exercise, where 60% of an individual's maximum intensity level is reached, gut damage may occur. And it's very common with running and cycling. So I get that we get this question a lot too, which is like, you know, I was kind of restricting. I was running a lot. I wasn't eating enough. And now I just can't eat anything anymore. And I think that's really interesting to note, is that this like constant endurance exercise can actually cause long-term damage to your gut. But what I would recommend is somehow stress is exacerbating gut issues for you. It may be related to stress from this moderate exercise. It may be related to the type of exercise that you're doing. It may be related to, maybe you do have some sort of adrenal dysfunction. The only way to really know is to get testing done and to see where are your hormones at and what's your gut health look like. So I would recommend, instead of trying to say like, well, how do I fix this? How do I make it so that, you know, I can do a moderate exercise and not be bloated? I would say, what's going on with your gut, and maybe what's the root cause of that? Because it's the root cause is not the moderate exercise, right? It's a different root cause. So I would go to doing some sort of like a GI MEP test, looking at your gut and seeing if there's anything, if there's any dysfunction, if there's any infection going on there. With Jennifer, I think all the information about decreasing cortisol is really important. And it's really important to continue to test. So I don't know why you think that you should run. I do not recommend running for various reasons, which, again, I know that's hard to hear. Like, as a runner, as somebody who worked in the running industry, I was a super fan. And I know that a lot of people do. My husband does it still. But I also can see that it's not right for a lot of people and a lot of women. And it doesn't really produce positive health outcomes, especially in your scenario where you're already stressed out, you're already having a problem managing cortisol and stress output. I would really recommend moving away from that simply for hormone balancing and gut health, and look into doing more restorative types of exercise. So I think that a lot of people, like, we get the question too, like, well, I need to run or else I'm going to lose my mind. Or like, you know, I have to do this high intensity workout every day. Like, I have to be working out every day or I'm just not going to be able to manage my, you know, anxiety or my mental health. And in that scenario, if you're doing more damage to your body, if you're overtraining, if you have this adrenal dysfunction, you've got to stop. Like, the only way to manage anxiety is not to do more damage to your body through overtraining and running. That's not your only solution. And so you've got to really come to head with, do I want to take myself down this path of further adrenal issues, further health issues, further overtraining, further injury, you know, further hormonal imbalance? Or do I want to meet what's actually, you know, my anxiety head on, tackle that, get to the root cause and you know, tackle it through a variety of ways and figure out what's going on there as opposed to, you know, tanking my health through high intensity exercise every day. And it's just a choice that you're going to have to make. And there are a lot of resources. There are so many things that you can do to kind of just help support your mental health. And I do think that there are other ways that you can work out that support health. Whether it's a casual bike ride or walking daily or, you know, being outside and walking, Pilates, stretching, there are a lot of low intensity things that you can do that really do show, you know, even in research, that it improves your mental health and leads to positive health outcomes. So those are my thoughts. Anything else that you want to add?
No, I talked about my personal experience, and I think I just take it from somebody who thought that I had to be doing it, mm-hmm. for my fitness, for my body to look the same, right? I actually think my body is responding to stopping better than it was to exercising a lot. So that's great. And also that information was very useful. I did not know about the gut and exercise 2-hour thing. And I was doing a lot of exercise that exceeded those limits this summer. So, yeah, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Question number 2 is from Linda. This is an interesting one. Can you talk about your journey from paleo to where you are now? Personally, paleo further distorted my view of food, i.e. good versus bad food. I've noticed you also have steered away from this. Why? Have you ever tried intuitive eating? What are your thoughts on it? Intuitive eating is a huge topic. We have talked about it a lot on this podcast, but I think I don't know. I'd be interested to know your thoughts. Like, now looking back, Stephanie Ruper, paleo for women, how do you think paleo impacted you? Did it, you know, lead to, did it distort your view of food? And what do you kind of think of it now? And then we can, you know, why did you move away from it? You obviously changed your, you know, your website and all that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because of internet algorithms.
For the most part. Yeah.
So, all right. Plain talk, honest talk, real talk. Is that what the description of our podcast is?
That's what we say
real
nowadays.
Talk.
Yeah.
I never liked the label of paleo because I don't like labels, but I used it because it was close to what I was doing and it was a popular search term. Yeah. So, like, the paleo movement and community was cool and had a lot of cool people in it. And I thought, okay, I can be a part of this discourse, right? But you'll notice, anybody who's read my first book, Sexy by Nature, that I never once actually used the word paleo to describe the foods that I recommend. You know, Stephanie, paleo for women. Like, I knew that the trend was going to, like, I knew it. It was just, it was a word that caught on after Lauren Cordain published, you know, the paleo diet. And it was useful for talking about this approach to food that I maintain to this day, that the best way to craft hypotheses about what's good to eat is to look at the human body as an evolved body. Right? We have an evolutionary history. We should pay attention to it. We should pay attention to science and sort of like meet there. It is science to think about the human body as an evolved body. And that is still what I preach, if I preach anything. So, yeah, I ended up changing I you know, paleo became a hard word years before I changed the name of my website. And I was okay with sticking with it because I was paleo for women, and that was fine. And that was how people found me. But I ended up having some trouble with the changes Google had made to its search algorithms, and also wanting my work in the health space to be a little bit more seamless with the work that I do in other spaces, right? I work in philosophy and existential health and that sort of thing, and have, you know, done a PhD in the academy, right? In philosophy, in religion. I studied religion. But so Health to Empower really helped me ground, you know, what I'm doing, and changing the label, sure, but what I've done hasn't changed at all, because all along, I mean, like, Sexy by Nature was written to heal and to inspire and to empower with knowledge and with getting in touch with your body. And that's how I feel about all of this stuff. And I continue to feel that way, and I will forever probably feel that way. So that's sort of how I relate to paleo. And as to, like, its ability to make foods good or bad, I would say that I'm very sorry if that has done that to anybody in this community, and to you, Linda. I will also say, however, that is a problem in every single diet that you will ever encounter, right? Any sort of prescription, when somebody says, these are the rules you follow, you know, whether it's the seven foods of JJ Virgin's thing, or the Whole30 thing, or any of the things, the keto thing, the bean diet thing, whatever, all the things. There is a list of foods, like, the people who create these have to give you guidelines, right? There's the list of foods that are in and the list of foods that are out, and they will be labeled good and bad. Mm. And then, you know, you can get stuck in it or not. And so I think what serves us best is to learn about science and to learn about various approaches and to experiment with them, but to understand that we are the autonomous thing that chooses amongst these options. And no food is morally good or bad. Some might be physically good or bad for you at some point or another. And the merits of, you know, eating those things we can debate all day long. But this sort of thing has to be fluid, and it has to be dependent on you, right? It has to be dependent on your physiology and what it can handle at any given point in time. And so, that's how I feel about it. And I very much stand by what Noelle and I said in Coconuts and Kettlebells, the book. I think that that's a really reasonable approach to, you know, this bio-individual, reasonable science-based approach to just figuring out what works for you. That just, okay.
Yeah, we intentionally didn't put the word paleo in there at all. And
the
actually,
new paleo.
Yeah, we actually were, what we wanted to write was, like, the new paleo. I think what is interesting, and what Steph has done, well, let me jump back. So Stephanie was, like, one of the first people ever to be talking about, definitely in the paleo movement, but been in the holistic health movement, speaking out against some of the garbage talk that exists when we're talking about, you know, weight.
Wow, that is so nice for you to say.
But, you know, she was the first person really talking out against some of the negative impacts that what we've now come to call diet culture. I don't think we were really calling it that back then. But, like, what we've now come to talk, you know, about this diet culture and how toxic it is. Like, Stephanie was the first one to really be speaking out against that publicly. And even, like, in the belly of the beast at PaleoFX, you know, you were quoted as saying, like, I eat 12 apples some days because that's what I have my hands on and that's what I want. And no matter what that, you know, what were you trying to say in the moment, you were still kind of coming out against this really, like, early paleo was very, you know, all you need is a few berries. You don't need to, you know, it was very negative against
a slab of meat.
Yeah, no, very negative towards carbs. I remember my CrossFit, the guy who owned my CrossFit gym, which was, like, one of the first CrossFit gyms, was very against apples. He did not want you to eat apples. And some of us, I remember, like, you know, a lot of us bought into that. So I think that I kind of see paleo through two different lenses, which is that first sort of more restrictive phase where it was, we turned apples and carrots and bananas into really bad foods. And it was like very restrictive and not enjoyable. And I even remember my CrossFit, the owner, being like, why are you getting mushrooms on your salad? Like, you don't need to get mushrooms. It's not like they're not. And I'm like, because I want mushrooms on my salad. Like, really? Are you going to go after me about mushrooms because they're not nutrient dense enough? Like, it's not enough fat for you? Like, what? So anyway, it was just like that attitude, I think in the beginning was fairly negative, but I do think there was quite the shift. And largely pressed on by some of the, and largely pushed by some of the women in the paleo community, and the recognition that we do need sufficient calories. And yeah, we do need a good whack of carbs, not just like a single sweet potato during the day, you know, if we're doing high intensity exercise. And so we've kind of course corrected. And I do like where the movement eventually moved to. Paleo as a word and as a term obviously is no longer popular. And I do think that we've, like, looking back, it was a way of helping me out of disordered eating, helping me out of this very strict vegan vegetarian dogma, and seeing that, like, oh, maybe this dogma, it was kind of like opening my eyes that, like, oh, the dogma and the science and this literature was very one-sided that I was viewing before, and that's maybe not right, and I can eat fat, like, holy cow, I can eat fat. So for me, it was more, it actually helped, it was a process of helping me heal. I was able to eat fat again. And I think that really helped me mentally. And so it just, but again, it wasn't the solution, right? It wasn't the solution to any sort of disordered eating. It's not the solution to eating disorders. Another diet is never going to solve that. But what Stephanie and I think what we did differently is we kind of created our new, a new paleo. We kind of created this new, and that's what we wanted to write. That's what we wanted the title of the book to be. And I'm so glad we didn't write that book. But, you know, that's kind of what we did with the podcast, and eventually moved away from it because of the fact that, you know, there are strict rules around it, and we don't necessarily believe that those strict rules are absolutely necessary to follow for health. Do I think it's an absolutely wonderful protocol for a lot of people, and a lot of people can find health by following it? Simply because it's reducing a lot of the inflammatory foods, and it's improving nutrient density, and it's really focused on quality. Yes, yes, yes. I think it's actually pretty awesome. And so I even sometimes find myself still saying, like, we a more paleo-ish approach. Like, we just don't eat, you know, a lot of grains. We're not eating, you know, like, that's not, we don't hardly eat grains at all, especially not for my husband because he has Hashimoto's and we don't do dairy. We do some of our own cheese, but really it's very rare, you know, so we're still different, and it's hard to find a way to describe that, you know, like, no, we don't have milk in our fridge. Like, we just, but it's different. And so I still find that term endearing in some way. And when I'm searching recipes, and I pulled all of you, you told me that when you're searching for baked goods that are grain-free and dairy-free, you just search paleo brownies. You know, it's still a search term that people use when they're looking for recipes. And so I do tag it onto my recipes too. But I do think that, it's interesting. And we definitely moved away from it, was because that term turns people away. That term is now kind of a turnoff. And I understand that because it is restrictive. It what people who aren't in the paleo movement and who don't listen to this podcast and see the new paleo that Steph and I have created, or what we had created when we had the Paleo Women podcast, it's a negative connotation. People who aren't into paleo they're not like, oh, let me listen to the Paleo Women podcast. So it was important for us to move away from that and really stay focused on quality and holistic health and mindset and all the things that we had been talking about. But paleo just wasn't really serving any us or I think our community anymore. So would you agree?
Yeah, it was brilliant. Thank you.
When I started following Stephanie, it was because I had heard her talk about Sexy by Nature on Abel James's podcast. And it was sort of this, like, somehow I had art, like, it wasn't new information to me, but it was really important. It was impactful for me that somebody was talking about it on, like, a huge podcast. You know what I mean? Like, somebody was actually speaking out about it. And so that, I mean, that's why I say you were kind of paving the way for that. Because I think people also, what's really interesting to think about is the internet has been developing and evolving, and blogs have been evolving, and we've been right in the middle of all of that. So, like, you know, in 2007, 2008, I kind of started my own little, like, that's when blogging started kind of picking up speed. And that's when I graduated from college. And, you know, we were kind of, and that, you know, right at the cusp in the beginning of this paleo movement is when we were kind of getting into the internet world. And so people weren't talking about body image and diet culture and being able to call out these things. It wasn't something that people were doing on the internet, really. And I mean, that's why, you know, when I did my I don't want six pack abs thing and I showed a picture of my stomach without abs, like, holy crap, some woman did this. You know, it was revolutionary and everybody was sharing it. Whereas nowadays, it wouldn't even be a blip on the radar. Yeah. And I mean, people weren't doing things on Instagram, like Instagram pictures. That wasn't a big deal in the beginning. So it was just the way people got out information was like blogs. And even that was a little bit of a challenge. So anyway, you know, it's kind of interesting when you look back and think on it now. See how that evolved. This has gone really long. I apologize.
It's very interesting.
Let's jump to question number four, which is from Diane. Actually, can you answer question number three? I think probably you could answer it, give some ideas of what could be causing, because I know you've gone through this personally. Question number three is from Catherine. It says, this year I've started waking up in the middle of the night with heart racing, trouble getting back to sleep. I can't figure out a pattern and why it's happening.
Yeah, so this is enormously complex, and I've wrestled with it for many, many, many years. And there is a lot of potential things that could be for you that weren't for me and that sort of stuff. I suppose the most important thing to look to, I'll point to two or three things. One is blood sugar. This is probably the most commonly talked about. If you have blood sugar swings throughout the day, or if you eat a bunch of sugar close to bedtime, and your sugar levels crash, and then your body attempts to correct for it in the middle of the night, that will put you into like a mode of adrenal upregulation, which can make your heart beat really fast and wake you up. So that's one option. Another, of course, is circadian rhythm dysregulation, which comes from so many different things. Caffeine at the wrong time of the day, too much exercise, poor meal timing. If you are not eating much early in the day and then you eat a ton late at night, that's going to throw off your natural circadian rhythm. It is pretty embedded in us to eat earlier in the day, and you can snack at night, and I always do. I always eat before bed, but the majority of my calories I push to earlier in the day, and it's made a lot of difference. Anytime, if you're going hungry a lot, if you're fasting, if you're intentionally feeling hungry, this is there's a part of your brain in your hippocampus, it will wake up. It will wake you up in the middle of the night if you are spending too much time in an underfed state. It's been demonstrated in rodent studies. It happens in humans. It's very clear that, especially for the females, less so for the males, that if you are in an underfed state, then that can happen to you. In which case, increasing your calories and getting your meals regularly spaced throughout the day and making sure you don't go to bed hungry with a nice balance of carbs and fat, I think is really good. Another thing to look out for is too much protein late at night. Protein blocks the absorption through the blood-brain barrier of tryptophan, which helps you sleep. And protein is also dehydrating. Like, it requires water. If you eat a lot of protein late at night, you might want to try shifting your protein to earlier in the day. And then carbs, complex carbs. I have beans and vegetables without any fat that's usually my like evening snack, my like before bed snack, because I get to do a little bit of bean protocoling, which is great, good for my body's detox processes. And I get a thwack of fiber and complex carbs, which help your body. Insulin helps your body carry tryptophan across the blood-brain barrier, but only in the absence of tons of other proteins. So also if you're eating a super low carb diet, then definitely throwing some carbs in, especially later in the day, can be really, really good for you. You also want to make sure your electrolyte balance is on point, because if it isn't, say if you're eating a ton of salt or you're not eating enough, being hydrated is really important. That's another thing that we tend to not understand can like cause adrenal, you know, upregulation or issues, because your adrenal glands do fire when your body is working hard to balance the electrolytes in your blood. And you like have to balance the electrolytes in your blood. Like if you don't, you die, right? So your body works really, really hard to make this happen. Your adrenal glands and your brain can be stimulated in the process of that. So making sure that you get a good balance of water and salt. If you drink too much, like I'm not kidding, if you drink too much water, you're going to be flushing electrolytes out of your system, and that's a problem. So try to pay attention to legitimate thirst, and it's so common these days for people to drink gallons and gallons of water. And I'm like, if you're not consuming electrolytes at the same time, then that's actually, I think it's doing more harm than good. So I'm going to flag those things as options, as things to sort of look into. And of course, the orange light and the blue light, and all the stuff we talk about for circadian rhythms is really important. All right.
Cool. Last question is from Diane. She says, how can we flush excess hormones out safely? I will jump in and
you go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think there's two parts to this. And the first is limiting what's coming in. Specifically, we're talking about like xenoestrogens and products and like cleaning products, skincare products, all that stuff that exposes you to xenoestrogens, also heavy metals. And then the second part is supporting your organs of elimination. So I think, and we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, but xenoestrogens, basically they act as estrogen in the body by binding to estrogen receptor sites. So they're all around us, but really the main source that we're exposed to on a daily basis is our skincare products and our cleaning supplies. Yes, what you put on your skin is absorbed into your body. Not everything, that's also a lie, but things that you put on your body are actually absorbed into your bloodstream, and they can have very measurable and almost immediate changes on levels in your blood. So that's really important. This is why skincare is important. This is why makeup is important. And also what's in the powders that you're using, because a lot of that can be contaminated. Those are typically things that are contaminated with heavy metals. You can breathe those in. So things that you breathe in typically have more harmful effects than like what you'd put on your skin. And then reducing overall heavy metal exposure. Some research has suggested that heavy metals like cadmium and lead can mimic estrogen in the body and even bind to estrogen receptor sites, and that's the pathway in which they become carcinogenic. Obviously, there's a lot of concern when it comes to chronic aluminum exposure. So really, when we're talking about we can't go without mentioning, you got, like, you see a funnel, and you're trying to get, you know, the end of the funnel is the excretion, whether it's through urine or poop, and you're trying to get your hormones out, right? And properly excrete hormones and support detoxification. The number one thing you can do is like stop putting in stuff into the funnel. You know, you have to remove the excess. And that a lot of that can lead to estrogen dominance. But through excretion, the way that you want to support your organs, really the main focus is on the liver and the gut. However, you have a lot of detoxification organs, your liver, your kidneys, your gut, your whole lymphatic system, your lungs, your skin, and even your sweat glands. So the liver is responsible for binding hormones and then converting them into methylated forms. So when they're methylated and they're bound, they can properly be transported into the gut and safely excreted. And they can also be excreted by the kidneys through your urine. So one of the ways that you can support this process is really to support proper liver function. And, you know, if you're not... The other big thing that, of course, we always talk about is gut health. because if you're constipated and your poop isn't moving, you're not excreting on a daily basis, what can happen is that estrogen, once it starts sticking around longer than it should, it goes back into circulation in the body, because while it's sitting around, it's actually separated from that methyl group and goes right back into your body. So supporting proper liver function is, this is why I think paleo is typically a good thing overall, because it does really support this and it does support a lot of the things that we recommend on a daily basis, which is eat cruciferous vegetables daily, like broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage. This group of vegetables naturally helps in the production of indole and DIM, which supports estrogen excretion. Eat foods rich in heme iron and B vitamins. That's your grass-fed meats, your organ meats. Eat sulfur-rich foods. Eat the yolks, folks. Liz Wolf coined that with her book, Eat the Yolks, but it's true. Take a magnesium supplement. This is absolutely crucial for supporting detoxification pathways. And then cut back on alcohol or avoid it completely. And then supporting your gut. Of course, remove those offending foods. Remove foods that are high in, that are highly processed, high in processed sugars. And then incorporate anti-inflammatory foods like your cold water fish. And then supplements. I do think that it could be beneficial in certain cases. NAC is really, it helps support glutathione production. It's a master antioxidant. It's known to support the liver, so you can try supplementing with that. Milk thistle is also one of those well-known liver-supporting nutrients, and you can get it just like in a separate pill. But what I like are like compound liver supplements where there's a couple different things that would support proper liver function. Dr. Becky Campbell, who we've interviewed on this podcast twice, has a Liver Love supplement, and it basically has some functional mushrooms like reishi and cordyceps, which are known to support the liver, and a couple other nutrients like milk thistle and NAC. And another thing that you can do is actually supplement specifically with DIM. And that becomes important when you have something like a SNP, in like a genetic SNP, where you can't properly excrete estrogen, which can happen, and that can be a common cause of estrogen dominance. But anything else from you to add?
Nope.
Lots of chatty chat today. This is a long episode. Thanks for being here. Thanks for sticking it out with us. For more from Stephanie. I feel like I trip over myself every week with this. Health2empower.com. However, Instagram at Stephanie.Ruper is really the place where you'll find her and her newfound love for selfies. I really do appreciate them.
Fair enough.
Okay. You can find more from me at coconutsandkettlebells.com. Also Coconuts and Kettlebells on Instagram. Thanks for being here. We appreciate you all, and we will talk to you next week.